So Aldo seemed to think that from, was it yesterday's tutorial? Yeah. Where you went over aspects of D that, you know, you more or less had the exterior derivative covered. There are other online resources. I mean, you know, so if you want more detail, please refer to past year PSI lectures. But just to sort of, these are sort of the key formulae that we didn't get to on Wednesday. Just to note that the epsilon forms, it's an N form, but it's actually a sort of tensor density. Strict, you know, just if it's just the permutation symbol. So that if you do a coordinate transformation, then you get the determinant out in the front. So that's known as a tensor density or a form density, and that's the weight. So if we want to actually make a tensor, that would be, I call that one straight epsilon, this one curly epsilon. You would need a metric, and you would introduce a root g times that epsilon. And then that gives you a tensor, not tensor density. The Hodge dual, another important operator, takes you from lambda p to lambda n minus p. Again, you need this epsilon here. And this is what it looks like in components. Then D, this is how mathematicians would define D, and it's really just saying it takes you between lambda P and lambda P plus one. And I think the key thing, which I didn't mention when I was briefly saying that yesterday, was that D squared is zero. So what we will need today is this last identity here, which relates D and the Lie bracket. So remember, U and V are vectors. Omega contracted with V, if omega and V, omega's a covector field, V a vector field. This is in C infinity of M. So the vector's the linear operator acting on that function. And this is, again, ends up being a scalar function. So the main focus of today's lecture is going to be Cartan's structural equations. So these are a way of computing the curvature of a manifold very, very efficiently. Now, obviously, if you have a specific metric, so a specific geometry that you want the Riemann tensor of, I would not necessarily recommend you do it by hand. I would say, oh, just pop it on Mathematica, right? Because we're sort of, we get lazy, I think, with all the help we get. However, if you want to do something that's more general, like you've got maybe a manifold where you don't want to have a specific dimension, you want to sort of think about arbitrary dimensions, you have certain symmetry groups, so you know your metric has a certain form, but not necessarily explicitly what it is, then this is where this technique comes into its own, because you can far more easily say, well, I've got some, you know, like if I have an SON symmetry, I know I've got some sort of N-sphere sort of subspace or block of the metric. And so I don't have to do all the work computing the curvature of that. I just carry that all along. Okay, so a lot of this will be familiar because obviously you've covered connections and curvature, but it will be done from this slightly more geometrical perspective, which again may be partly familiar. But, you know, I don't think you've done the structural equations. So we've talked about finding derivatives. And so I'm just going to get you to recall what the definition of the connection is. Okay. So this is how we define the connection. So remember, the connection is about relating or connecting together the tangent spaces within the tangent bundle of the manifold. So what does that mean? Well, you start off perhaps with a basis at one point P, and then you want to know how that maps onto a basis at a neighboring point Q. So here's our basis, a vector's EA. So we know that an individual EA here is going to map onto some other vector here. So let's say that's E1, for example, or the image of E1. So this is really what this is telling you intuitively. It's saying, how do these tangent spaces sort of link together? And so this is expressing this in a differential form. It's saying, like, the rate of change of the basis is going to be, obviously, it's going to be some combination of the basis vectors in the nearby space. It's a rate of change, so that's our covector part. And then these here are scalars. So these are just numbers. This is our basis. And this is our co-tangent basis. And this is our derivation. So that's what the connection is, just as an abstract object. What we're interested in gravity is the metric connection. And what that really means is that grad g is zero. So grad is our sort of differential operator, and acting on g, it gives us zero. We usually also take the connection to be torsion free. So I just want to say a little bit about that. But before doing so, just in the spirit of the mathematics, so grad is a derivation. So these are the three properties that your covariant derivative must obey. Leibnizian is just saying that's what you usually get when you take derivatives. Reduces to D on functions, that seems to be the common theme with derivations, because that's where we kind of get back to something where we're absolutely confident we know what the derivative of a function is. And then commutes with contractions, that's just saying if I take grad of omega contracted with V, then I take it acting on omega and then contract with V plus omega on grad of V. And it's just saying that that process is commutative there. So that's how the mathematicians define a particular covariant derivative. So I guess here I am using this sort of phrase of connection and covariant derivative a little bit interchangeably, but that's really because I sort of start off by thinking, what is it that the covariant derivative is doing? If I want to take a derivative, I want it to somehow be genuinely adding an extra index, then I can't just do that by a normal partial differentiation. I've got to think about what happens to the bases, and that's where these connection components come in. So let's just make a comment about this torsion-free connection. So what people usually say is it's a symmetric connection. That's almost true, but not quite. So the torsion is a tensor. And this is how it's defined. So here, if you like, in components, this would be sort of UA grad A, okay? If we write it down in components. So we take the anti-symmetrized derivatives here, grad UV minus grad V of U, but then we add the Lie bracket to the end. So what that actually means is our components are not quite the anti-symmetric part of that connection. So we have these C's. So here, so remember I talked about that that sort of geometrical meaning of the Lie bracket. It may be that we choose a basis such that if we move a little bit along one vector element, the integral curves, and then along the other, it's not the same as going the other way round. So that doesn't happen for a coordinate basis, because by definition, coordinates are sort of unique labelings of points. So obviously, if we're labeling, say, a point by x and y, our x and y can't depend on whether we go first x, then y, or rather first y, then x. So coordinate bases always close, but we don't always want to use a coordinate basis. And of course, in a coordinate basis, the gamma's reduced to the normal Christoffels that you've already met. So now I want to just build on that a little bit and derive Cartan's first structural equation, which is all about finding the connection. So the first step is to introduce an object, the connection one forms. Actually, before I do so, I wanted to just emphasize something I realize I forgot to do. Notice that I have been careful to put that the index corresponding to the derivative in the first slot here. So we have to be careful about ordering, at this point at least. And that's important because, of course, here you see BC, CB, and the structure constants. And so it matters which index we put first. So the first one on the gamma downstairs is always the derivation index. So here what we're doing for the spin connection is we're mopping up that first index. So the first thing that I just need to establish, if we're computing a connection, is the symmetric part. So here, our metric, remember, is symmetric, which means the components of our metric are symmetric. And so this is telling us about the symmetric part of these connection one forms. So let's just see why that is the case. So first of all, remember, we're going to just look at the right-hand side for a bit. Remember, these are scalars. This is not a tensor. This is not abstract index notation. These are scalars. They are the components of the metric in a particular basis. So the covariant derivative reduces to D on functions. So that's my first step. And then I'm going to write down what these components are. So the components of the metric are just with respect to a given basis. So I take my second rank covariant. So it's a member of T star of M, tensor T star of M. And so that's a linear bilinear map from the vectors down to the reals. So that's what I've written there. Then remember, it's a metric connection. So grad G vanishes. This is also according to that first point there, commutes with contractions, which means I take grad inside here. So when it hits the G, it gives me nothing. So this is just G grad EA EB plus G EA grad EB. So that's commuting with contractions and Leibnizian property. Then I look at what grad EA is. So if I look at the top, I see that grad of a basis vector is equal to the connection one form contracted with the basis. So here, when I take grad EA, that is going to be the connection one form, so the connection components contracted over. So it's just this combination of basis vectors. So when I look at this, those are just scalars, I pull them out. So this first one is theta CA GCB plus theta CB GAC. And so what I get is theta BA plus theta AB. So that's just giving you some, I've gone through it in quite a bit of detail, but it's sort of bringing out a lot of the features, the fact that when you see the indices here, you have to remember these, this is not abstract index notation, these are components. What do you mean by components? Well, here, you know, this is a bilinear map, so that means you contract it with two basis vectors, and then you just kind of use the axioms of what of the covariant derivative there. So a common basis other than the coordinate basis is an orthonormal basis. So this is what we're going to use for the Cartan structural equations. And what that means is that we choose basis vectors or covectors such that the components of our metric are either 1 or minus 1, eta ab. So those are just constants, either plus or minus 1 or 0. So that tells us that d of GAB vanishes because they're just constants, which implies that theta is anti-symmetric. So in other words, we've just by choosing a judicious choice of basis, we have reduced a lot of the degrees of freedom in our connection. Okay, so now we're going to derive Cartan's first structural equation, which is all about computing that connection. So the first thing we do is define the torsion 2 form . So this is really just taking that torsion, first of all, taking the torsion tensor, looking at its components, and then we mop up the form part of it, the two-form part of it. In other words, the covariant indices here. So all I've done here is I've said, okay, I'm going to define this two form, or rather it's not one two form, there's actually a set of two forms because that index A is just a label and it runs from 1 to n or not 2 n minus 1. And then I write down what the components are. I use the fact that here, this is anti-symmetric under interchange of omega B and C to just take that half to one and a single gamma. And then in the last bit, I've just written down what those structure constants are. And so note that this first piece here, right, this thing here is theta AC wedge omega C. So given that in GR, our connection is torsion-free, what that tells us is in GR, this term has to cancel that term. This term has the connection one forms in it, so that's kind of what I said we were going to be looking for. Whereas over here, all I've got are objects that are related to the basis or properties of the basis, like the Lie bracket. Now, notice this here and that term there are the same, where I just slot in a covector basis element here and two vector basis elements there. So it means I can use this identity relating D to Lie. So let's just do that. So if instead, if I do that, if I enter in these basis elements, D omega A with EB EC, and I just copy off that bottom line there, so that's just literally transcribing the bottom line, putting in our covector and vector basis elements. But here, the definition of the covector basis is that these contractions give you the Kronecker delta. So this is, by definition, a set of constants, 0 or 1. And similarly there. So if you just have constants, when you act on them with the vector, the linear operator, this the thing that, remember, tf is df by dt along the curve, that just gives you 0. So both of those vanish. Therefore, I can take this expression here and just replace it with this expression, which is, again, just something involving the basis elements. So that tells me so this here is just the components of d omega a, and therefore essentially what I'm doing is I'm taking the components to get the scalars and then lifting it back up to being a two form. And so I end up with Cartan's first structural equation, which is that the torsion tensor two form is equal to D of the one form basis elements plus the connection one forms wedged with those one form basis elements. It's very, thank you, a question. Fantastic, yes.
Can you explain again why those two terms cancel in the top?
Yeah, so it comes by definition in the sense of we have a choice. We choose a vector basis, say, which we say is orthonormal. In other words, we take the components of G to be plus or minus 1. What is the definition of the covector basis? So this is the basis of the covector space that is dual to the particular basis of the vector space that you have chosen. And this is the definition of the dual basis. You choose it such that if you contract omega 1 with E1 is 1, but omega 1 with any other basis vector is 0.
Is it each term is vanishing on its own, or are they canceling?
No, so these inside here, these are constants. Yeah. And then remember that a vector is a linear map from C infinity of M to the reals, such that, you know, if we were going along a curve, right, it would be T of F is df by dt, where T parameterizes the curve at P. So if F is constant along the curve, TF is 0, right? And so that's just, as soon as you get constants, then you take the derivative of those, you got 0. So it's really just by, it's sort of by definition. I mean, again, a lot of the systems that we have familiarity with, such as Cartesian R cubed, you know, where we kind of think, oh, but, you know, we've chosen our IJK or EXEYZ, and, you know, the co-vector basis is exactly the same. But I think in crystallography, you'll see, you know, you tend to choose a basis which is aligned, I guess, with certain, you know, sort of directions in the crystal. And then when you take the dual basis, that's not the same as the vector basis. And the dual basis is defined such that, you know, the dual of E1 actor, you know, contract dotted with E2 and E3 is 0. Yeah? So that might, if that helps. So I realize at the moment, looking at that, it might be completely non-obvious as to why that helps you in any form, fashion, or way. But bear with me for a little bit, because I'm going to go on and talk about curvature, and then I'll do some examples.
Mm-hmm. Can you repeat the step, that last step?
From here to here. Yeah. Yeah. So here, this object sitting in here is the geometrical object. It's a two-form, because it's D acting on a one form, and D takes you from lambda P, in this case one, to lambda, sorry, that's a Hodge dual. Lambda P, which is one, to lambda P plus one, which is two in that particular case. So this is the geometric object. I then take the contraction of that with two basis vectors, EB and EC, and so that gives me, take a different color. So this here, these are the components. So these are the scalars, okay? But if you look at what I've done here with the definition of the torsion two form, that takes the components and turns it into a two-form. So finally, this last bit, the omega b plus omega c plus this combinatorial factor, that takes you back to the geometric object. So it's like you've gone forward and then you come back again. Yeah. I mean, obviously you wouldn't normally do that, but the reason that we've done it here is because we've sort of had to work with what we've got, and what we've got here is this expression, right? And so that's how we get there.
Bruce, mm-hmm. For the structure constant, is the first component B or A?
Sorry, is the first
Yeah, I wasn't sure about the location of the
which board?
Structure constant in the
Is it the top board? I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
Or in general, the C.
The C?
Component A or B.
Oh. Is it my writing? This?
Yeah.
A. Is that what you were asking?
The first component, or B is the first component, or is structure constant?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the question.
For gamma, you circled A to, or?
I circled the bottom, this thing here. It's the first of the downstairs indices, right?
Oh, yes.
So gamma is a, you know, it is, I mean, these are not tensors, right? So in a sense, it doesn't make it, you know, I can't talk about it being a covariant or contravariant or vector or covector object because it is not geometric. Those gammas are sets of numbers on the manifold, defined across the manifold. They're not a tensor, they are sets of numbers. They only make sense if you have a basis. So although we do, you will see, indices being raised and lowered on gammas, that's sort of, you know, because they're not really tensorial, that I would say be careful. But what I mean is the gamma here has got two components downstairs. Well, this is how we write it. And of these, we write the first component to be the differentiating index. Or differentiating index. And so for the structure constants, again, the ordering in the lower labels is important because it comes from a commutator. So that's important there. And the upper label is inherited because these are numbers. The commutator is a vector. The only way I can get a number from a vector is taking the linear map using a covector. So, you know, the labels, we're careful to put the labels upstairs or downstairs simply because that's kind of where they're, you know, when we derive those labels, the ones upstairs are coming from taking the contraction with an omega, and the ones downstairs are coming from vector basis elements. So I hope that helps. So again, you've seen curvature, so hopefully this is familiar. So the curvature of a connection is defined via a commutator of derivatives. So it's a trilinear map. So I'm not sure if that's how you saw curvature defined, but that is what the curvature of a connection is. So again, you see that pattern of swapping the order of differentiation, but as with a torsion tensor, you have that extra bookkeeping term, which is the derivative with respect to the Lie bracket. So that takes into account what you get if you're vectors don't commute. So it's this at a point, it takes you from TP of M to TP of M across TP of M into TP of M. So I'm not, again, you know, I'm not sure whether you've seen that expression in the presence of the structure constants, but those are the components of the Riemann tensor in the general basis. So I'm just going to state Cartan's second structural equation, since I went through the first one and its derivation. So Cartan 2 we first of all define, just like we did with Cartan 1, defining the torsion 2 form, we define a curvature 2 form. So notice here this anti-symmetry in this part of this bilinear map on U and V. And so what we do is we focus in on that part and we keep that as a geometric object. So this R is a 2 form, but it also has these indices A and B. So what this is it is a set of 2 forms which encode the curvature information of the manifold. So it is geometric, but we've also got these labels. So these labels do not behave tensorially. The 2 form does. So the second equation is that these curvature 2 forms are given by the exterior derivative of the connection 1 forms plus a wedge product of the connection 1 forms. So I would invite you to kind of compare that to non-abelian gauge theory and the field the stress tensor or the field strength of a non-abelian gauge field, where you get dA plus a commutator of 2As. So it's the same thing that you see cropping up. Okay. So why do I think these are useful? So let's see a very simple example first. So this is a very common combination in GR, the metric on a 2-sphere, and I might just, if I remember it, give it a radius of A. Okay, so that's our metric. So what I now want to do is define a basis. So, and I want it to be an orthonormal basis. So omega theta is going to be A d theta, and omega phi is going to be A sine theta d phi. So you can see in this case, I've been able to peel off my this is an orthonormal covector basis. So here, the components of the metric in this basis are just 1. Okay, so now let's apply this Cartan machinery. So for the first step, I just take the exterior derivative of this base, these basis elements, and this is where it gets easy. Okay, so d of this is just a d theta. D of a is a constant, so d of a vanishes. D theta, this would give me d squared theta, and d squared is 0, so that's just 0. And d of omega phi is just A cos theta d theta cross d phi. So all I'm doing is just differentiating that. Now I want to express this in terms of the basis element. So A d theta is omega theta. So that's omega theta. And d phi is 1 over A sine theta omega phi. So therefore this is, if I want to turn that into omega phi, I've got to turn that into a cot theta over A. Okay, so it's an orthonormal basis, so there's no symmetric part of the connection. The indices only run from 1 to 2. So that tells me that my anti-symmetric spin connection, it's 2x2 matrix that's anti-symmetric, it has one independent component, and I've already got it. So I can just read it off from Cartan's first equation. Here, I've calculated d omega phi. So d omega phi is minus theta phi theta wedge omega theta. And so I have to first, to make it wedge omega theta, I've got to swap the order of omega theta wedge omega phi. Gives me my minus sign. And so I just read off. Okay, now same thing with the curvature. I've only got one non-zero component, and that's phi theta. So here, all I get is the first term, because I've only got one independent component, so if I wedge it with itself, it vanishes. So d of this is minus sine theta d phi, sorry, d theta cross d phi, which is omega theta cross omega phi on a squared minus omega theta cross omega phi. I now look at that definition, RAB is a half RABCD omega C, wedge omega d, and I can just read off that, and I'm going to put hats here, the components of the curvature tensor in this orthonormal basis, there's only one independent component, which is 1 on a squared, but remember it's a it's an orthonormal basis. And so for the coordinate basis, so I just get one. And so in fact, what we see if we want to then write that in terms of a, you know, not the individual components to get all the right symmetries of the Riemann tensor, I can just write this down in terms of the metric. So this is a feature of a constant curvature space. Okay, well, that was a particularly trivial metric, but it was very straightforward. So let's ramp things up a bit. So our second example. It's going to be a static spherically symmetric metric. So again, we follow the same steps. Our first step is get the orthonormal basis. So here, this is going to be that omega t is going to be a dt, omega r is going to be b dr. And then I'm just going to, rather than doing omega theta and omega phi, I'm going to sort of call these if you like, omega alphas, which is going to be C omega naught alpha. So here, although I'm doing this in four dimensions, because I want you to sort of get the analogy with like finding the Schwarzschild solution, this is also trying to show you how you could carry along rather than having this being specifically S2, you could say, well, this is some constant curvature subspace. So I take a basis for this subspace. And so here, this could be arbitrary dimensions, okay? So I then, my next step is to take the derivative of this. So d of omega t is a prime dr cross dt. And this is then a primed over ab minus a primed over ab omega t cross omega r, the basis vectors, covectors. D of omega r vanishes. And then for the last lot, d of omega alpha. So I get c primed dr cross omega naught alpha. And then I've got plus c d of omega naught alpha. So the first piece So you see what I'm doing here is I'm trying to rewrite things so I can just pick off the connection one forms easily. And for the second piece, I'm saying that I've already done the work. If it was really an S2, I've already done the work finding the connection of that. But if it was a different space, I know what that little subspace is, so I'm just going to write that down using that Cartan's first equation. Okay, so I can now peel off. So now I have my connection. So I'm done, right? That is the connection for that, in that basis, the orthonormal basis. So the second step is the curvature. So RTR, let's start with the easy one. So there are, if I look at Cartan's second equation, the cross terms, theta AC wedge theta CB, there's the only non-zero connection form with a T is TR, so it doesn't pick up anything from that part. So this is D of A primed over B dt. So that's just A primed over B. Actually, let me put it on here. Dr cross dt. So that allows me to pick off some, at least one Riemann component. Which is in the orthonormal basis, which I have to remind you. And if I want to go to the coordinate basis, then I have to multiply by those functions that take you from the orthonormal basis to the coordinate basis. So that's one set of Riemann done. Now let's look at the other components involving T. So there's no theta, there's no connection components involving T alpha, but the cross term now contributes. So here we've got TR. We do implicitly have R alpha, but notice that over here it's written as alpha R. So this, we've got to swap the order, drop the R index and raise the alpha index. Swapping the order gives us a minus sign, because these are anti-symmetric, the spin connection. Let me write this separately because there's a bit too much going on. So theta R alpha so we've got we have to sort of raise the R index, lower the alpha index. And so what we get is minus C prime over CB omega alpha, or plus C prime over CB omega with the alpha downstairs. So what this tells me is, feeding that back in over here, is that I identify that RT alpha. And I'm not sure you, I'm going to just put the conclusion of that calculation on the side. So just to finish off, if we have purely angular pieces, I've now got three contributions. So this is just d of theta naught, alpha beta. The last piece is just theta naught, alpha gamma, wedge theta naught, gamma beta. And then in the middle, we get a minus sign because of the swapping of the order of the indices, omega alpha wedge, omega beta. And so I can pair the first and the last term to get r naught alpha beta minus c prime squared over c squared b squared, omega alpha wedge, omega beta. And so that allows me to pick off, there's a bit, you've got to sort of think a bit here about the, you know, the symmetries that you're trying to get. Okay, so that is now the Riemann tensor of that space-time. And in fact, nowhere have I used the fact it's four-dimensional. So that would also be the Riemann tensor of something, a higher dimensional metric that was spherically symmetric. So in 4D, okay, so that is our Ricci tensor. I'll just comment where it would change if you were in higher dimensions. So we get, I think. And maybe in there as well. Can't remember. So you only start to pick up the dimensionality of that subspace once you start contracting indices to get down to the Ricci tensor. So that's, that would be in that C prime squared there as well. It would also be D minus 3. Okay, so I don't know if you've slogged through the calculation of the Riemann tensor, going through calculating the Christoffels and then calculating the expression for all the Riemann components using the expression in terms of the Christoffels, but it's kind of long and it's very easy to drop a term or two along the way. Whereas here, because you're just doing some very simple differentiation, it's a lot harder to make a mistake, though not impossible. And it also, what you see is I've carried along a sort of arbitrary subspace, not just an S2. I didn't really use the S2 till that very last bit. And so it doesn't have to be an S2, it could be an H2, it could be an R cubed, it could be Calabi-Yau, it could be anything you like, because all you're doing is you're hiding it all in these sort of general expressions. So it's a lot more efficient as a mechanism of calculating curvature. And I think I should stop. Have I overrun?